Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the wild pigs of the Okefenokee when we come back. In 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now that clause follows the biblical injunction that we see on just weights and balances in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and that of clad coin or currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper money over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property and property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away the people's gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to own property and to destroy those property rights. And that's exactly what they did. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now let me teach you how to do just that in this business school, which is now on compact disc for adult home school. Now for more information about private business and our private business school, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package first. Now that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. My business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and then send an email request for that free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. The wild pigs of the Okefenokee. Back during the Revolutionary War, when people were too busy to care about what was going on in the southern part of Georgia, some hogs, wild hogs, actually they were tame when they went wild, but they got loose and they found their way into the Okefenokee swamp on the Georgia-Florida border. At that time, Florida was occupied by the Spanish. And during the Revolutionary War, nobody was too concerned about the wild hogs of the Okefenokee, but it made for interesting country lore, and it made for some good sporting and good shooting. Over the years, though, as the wild hogs became wilder and freer, going into the swamp to kill one oftentimes ended up in the death of a hunter, or in many cases, many hunters could sport a wooden leg or an arm that had been chewed off, and they could brag about how they had escaped with their lives from the wild boars or the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. This went on from the Revolutionary War to the turn of the century in 1900. It was quite a story to tell. There were more than 3,000. Some people said 60,000. Some people said 600,000. You know how stories sometimes get exaggerated. The real number was around 3,000. They were wild and they were free. They ate snakes and roots and acorns. They fared quite nicely for themselves. They didn't come out of the swamp very often. They minded their own business, and they multiplied, and they were wild, and they were free. Just like Americans all over the colonial states and later the United States of America, they were wild and free. Well, about 1900, an old trapper by the name of Jedediah Smith had been trapping up in North Dakota. Old Jed was born in 1830, and by 1900, he was already an old man, 70 years old. 6'2" and weighed 250 pounds, a bear of a man. Still with all of his faculties and just as tough as nails. He owned a Studebaker wagon, one of the big old covered wagon types, with a team of percher and horses. He kept all of his trapping gear and equipment in the wagon. He traveled all over the Pacific Northwest. He had been trapping, catching beaver, and trapping and making his living as a hunter all of his life. Well, except for the Civil War years. And then after the Civil War, when the railroads were building toward the West, he hunted buffalo and supplied meat to the Union Pacific Railroad and the thousands of workers that had built that railroad in the 1860s. Well, old Jed had heard about the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. And 3,000 hogs at $10 a pig would be about $30,000 if he could catch them. Now, of course, catching wild hogs was something that old Jed had never done, but old Jed had been a student of human nature. He'd been a student of animals. He'd been a hunter and trapper all of his life. And he thought, what a way to end my life if I could go down there and capture all, or if not all, most, and if not most, a goodly portion of the wild pigs of the Okefenokee. So in the fall of 1899, old Jed loaded up his equipment in his wagon and he headed south. And about January of 1900, he pulled into a small town on the edge of the Okefenokee Swamp on the Georgia side. He pulled up to the general store, which also served as the feed store, and he went inside. And sitting inside around a big potbelly stove was five or six of the locals and, of course, a couple of customers and the guy that owned the general store. And everybody could see that the stranger was somebody that they could look up to, 6'2", 250 pounds. Old Jed was an impressive specimen, if there ever was one. Well, old Jed struck up a little conversation, and he turned the conversation toward the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. After all, that's why he was there, and if he could get any local lore, he certainly wanted to hear it, and he got his ear full. Some of the locals told him some pretty wild stories, exaggerating, of course, as people tend to do, like catching a fish that's 12 inches long. When you show your hands, it's about 16 or 18. And they talked about the thousands of hogs and how many pigs were there and how wild and ferocious they were, and Jed took it all in, and one of the guys asked him, he said, well, you seem to be kind of familiar with the wild hogs. How'd you hear about them? And he said, well, nearly every trapper, every hunter in the country has heard about the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. And nobody's ever come down to trap them because of the swamp and all and the difficult terrain. And he said, when they asked him why he was there, he said he'd come down to try his hand at catching the wild hogs or trapping them. And a couple of the guys, one of them showed him a leg that had been chewed off, and he told his story that he'd been attacked by the wild hogs and he lost a leg in the process. And another guy had lost an arm, another guy had lost an eye, and everybody in the store, it seemed over time, you know, had at least once or twice had a run-in and a story to tell about the wild hogs. And they always described them as wild and free, and that they had lived on acorns and snakes and roots and wild vegetation in the swamp and carrion, and they'd been wild and free for more than 100 years, and that no man alive could go into that swamp and come out alive. The hunters would go along the edge of the swamp, and if they could catch one out in the outlying areas of the swamp, they'd take one, and they would feel good that they had a trophy. Nobody would venture into the swamp for fear of never coming out, and many a man had gone into the swamp and never returned, simply to be killed and eaten by the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. Well, old Jed thanked everybody for their input, and he ordered 5 tons of corn. He loaded the 5 tons of corn onto his big Studebaker wagon and ambled on down the road toward the swamp. And the old-timers around there said, that's the last you'll see of that guy. That Yankee will never come out of there alive. Well, a couple months went by. About March, old Jed came into town. Wagon was empty, stopped at the general store, went in, talked to the boys, ordered another 5 tons of corn, and paid for it in gold. And, of course, everybody was curious about what he was doing. And they were surprised, of course, that old Jed had even survived for 2 months. Since they hadn't heard anything from him for 2 months, most of the locals thought that, hell, he'd gone into the swamp and been killed and eaten, and his horses had been killed and eaten right along with him. No, sir, old Jed had survived for 2 months, hadn't had any serious run-ins, didn't have much to say about his experience, loaded up his corn and headed on out of town. A couple months went by. About the 15th of May, old Jed came back into town again, ordered another 5 tons of corn and headed on out, went on into the swamp or down to the swamp, and people began to talk about this crazy Yankee from North Dakota who would continuously come into town, buy corn, head off toward the swamp. Stories abounded about witchcraft and about how old Jed must be the right hand of Satan and the devil because he hadn't been killed and eaten yet. And about how he was strange and buying corn and feeding the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. Surely the man must be addled, if not totally insane. Well, summertime, about the 15th of July, rolled around and old Jed came into town, picked up another 5 tons of corn, and headed on out again. Of course, every time old Jed would show up, the stories would just fly all over town. Everybody wanted to know about this old trapper, and the old trapper was pretty close-mouthed. He wasn't talking much. People would ask him what he was doing, where he was going, one thing and another, and old Jed, he'd talk, but he wouldn't tell. He'd just talk without telling, and he'd go about his business and go on back down to the swamp. About September, old Jed came into town, picked up another 5 tons of corn, and ambled on out of town again. Now, this had been going on all year, you know. He came in January and March and May, July, here's September. And everybody's talking about this whole crazy Yankee from North Dakota and what he was doing down there. And of course, you know, you can just about put your own spin on the stories that they were telling about him. So about 15th of November, old Jed comes into town and he goes into the general store and they said, well, I suppose you want another 5 tons of corn. Jed said, no, I don't need any corn. I need to hire about 50 wagons. You see, I've got about 3,000 hogs penned up in the swamp, and they've got nothing to eat, and they're totally dependent on me, and if we don't get in there and get them off to market, why, they'll starve to death. And everybody fell just stony silent, and they were just absolutely dumbfounded. Some said, you're a liar. There's no man alive that could trap the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. Why, those hogs have been free and wild for more than 100 years. They've been wild since the Revolutionary War. Why, those hogs have been killing people, killing animals. Why, they've been eating carrion and roots and acorns and rooting around for over 100 years. And you mean to come in here and tell us that you've got them trapped and penned up and they're squealing because they're starving? Well, Jed said, yes, sir. Yes, sir, that's correct. So $10 a hog times 3,000 hogs is $30,000. Now, that was a princely sum in 1900. Just multiply that times 10. That's about $300,000 today. And here's this one lone old-timey trapper says he's got 3,000 hogs penned up in the Okefenokee, squealing for feed, starving to death, unless he comes in, picks them up, hauls them off to market. So immediately everybody wanted to know, well, how did you do that? How did you trap those hogs? So Jed, he sat down, he said, well, after I got here in January and I listened to what you boys had to say about those wild hogs, I knew that I might have bit off a little more than I could chew. After all, 3,000 is a lot of pigs, and as wild as those pigs were reported to be, I was a little bit concerned about that. So I thought I'd use an old trapper's trick, and that is to make my quarry dependent upon me. So I went out to the swamp, and I didn't go in, and I just stayed on the outside. And I could see a few hogs, you know, from time to time. And I spread out a little corn, and I'd go back about every day or two, and I'd put out the corn, and in the early part, nobody would come out and eat the corn. But as the hogs saw me coming out every day or two and putting corn out, some of the older, weaker, and some of the younger, dumber pigs would come out of the swamp, and they would partake of the free lunch. They would eat that free corn. Not much. After all, they'd all been wild and free, and they were living on their own, eating acorns and rooting out roots, eating carrion, doing their thing. But little by little, you know, that easy corn out there was just too tempting. And so little by little, those hogs could see that I wasn't any threat to them, and that, in fact, I just meant to do them good. And so they lost their fear of me. And so little by little, I put out more and more corn, and little by little, more and more pigs would come out. Finally, I had nearly all the hogs of the Okefenokee coming out of the swamp to eat the free corn. It took 3 or 4 months to get them to come out of the swamp to eat that free corn, but pretty soon they could see that I wasn't any threat to them. And in addition to that, it was easy feed, and it certainly supplemented their natural wild forage. Little by little, I began to feed the hogs in the swamp a little bit further. And so every day I'd go out and I'd feed the swamp, feed the pigs. And I'd put the feed in, you know, another 100 feet, and then another 100 feet, and then another 100 feet. And pretty soon I was able to go in a quarter of a mile. And pretty soon I had all the pigs eaten in the center of the swamp in the big 5-acre opening. There's a big opening, about 5 acres, a little pasture out there, about the middle of the swamp, and I had them all eaten there in that 5 acres. So I just went ahead and pitched my camp there, and every day I'd go out and feed the hogs, and when they get through eating corn, they'd go out and lie around in the sun. They'd go out and eat wild snakes and root around and get their acorns and root around and eat carrion, and they were just living the life of a pig. Little by little, the pigs began to depend more and more on corn and less on acorns. After all, it took time, effort, and energy, and a lot of work to go out and find their own food. And so, as time went on, more and more pigs would come to the center of the swamp to eat. And even the wildest, even the biggest, even the orneriest, learned to come and eat the free corn in the center of the swamp. After all, I was no threat to them, and all they had to do was come and eat all they wanted. And they could always go out and eat snakes and roots and acorns and carrion and whatever else they could find. And little by little, from the weakest and the oldest to the biggest and the strongest, they all became addicted to and depended upon the free corn. After all, it was free. And after all, I was no threat. So as the wild hogs quieted down and tamed down and began to eat on a regular basis the free corn, I began to dig post holes around the 5 acres. After all, that was no threat to anybody. They could walk in and out between the fence posts. And where I didn't have fence posts, they could come in the other side. After all, digging holes and putting posts in the ground wasn't any threat. And they all got used to the posts. After all, it started with 1 post and 2 posts and 5 posts and 10 posts and 20 posts and 50 posts. And finally, I'd put in about 600 posts. Cut, felled trees, put in 600 posts. And all of the pigs got used to it, and there was no threat to them. They could walk in and out through the posts all the way around the opening, eat their free corn, walk back out, lie in the middle of the opening, and they got used to that. And then one day, I started splitting rails, and I put one rail on the bottom all the way around. I left 2 openings, one on each side of the big 5-acre clearing, so that the biggest and the fattest and the weakest and the smallest could walk through the openings. The strongest and the biggest and the wildest, they could just jump over one rail. And after all, I only put up a few rails every day, and then every day the hogs would see me working, putting in posts and then working, splitting rails and then working, putting on one rail down at the bottom all the way around the 5 acres. And the hogs could go in, eat the free corn, and go out anytime they wanted. And then I split some rails and I put on a second rail. And when I put on the second rail, some of the oldest and fattest and some of the weakest and the smallest could no longer jump over 2 rails. But it was no threat to them. After all, there were 2 big openings, 16-foot gates, and they could walk in and walk out anytime they wanted. And of course, the strongest and the biggest, they could jump over 2 rails. So it was no threat to anybody. And after all, I'd been there for so many months, and I was so normal and so natural in the environment. And as time went on, the hogs became more and more dependent upon the corn. And when I started in the opening, I fed them every 3 days, and then it got to be every 2 days, and pretty soon I had to feed them every day. And they would be in the opening, and they would be squealing and waiting to be fed. The hogs had in one time been wild and free and could feed themselves and could take care of themselves, little by little were becoming less and less active and less able to find feed for themselves. And as new pigs were being born, after all, they were born right into the big opening in the center of the swamp. And as they grew up and were weaned, they had free corn. They never knew what it was to be wild and free. And then as time went on, I put on a third rail. And then finally I put on a fourth rail and then a fifth. Well, by the time I got the third rail on, the pigs could no longer jump over. And I reinforced all of the rails in case some of the bigger pigs would try to break out. I put on heavy-duty rails that the pigs couldn't break. And I put them close together so that the little ones couldn't squeeze through between the rails, or between the ground and the first rail, or the first rail and the second rail. But it was no threat, and all of the pigs were now used to the fence. After all, many of the pigs had been raised and didn't know anything but the heart of the swamp and the 5 acres in the center, being fed corn every day. And after all, the oldest and the wildest now were participating and partaking of the free lunch, the free corn. Little by little, the hogs would go through the 2 gates, eat the corn, and then go out through the 2 gates. Then one day, I built a gate, and I hung the gate on one of the openings. I didn't close it. I just left it there open, and the hogs were now used to going into the opening through the gates. Now they were used to going through one gate that had a gate on it. Then I built a second gate, and I put the second gate, and then I hung it. The hogs now, some of them were beginning to get more and more nervous, and they would be slower and slower to come in, and they would stop, and they would look, and they would sniff and snort, looking at the gates. Through all of this, there were some hogs that would not participate or partake of the free corn. There were some hogs that would not eat in the center of the swamp. There were some hogs that stayed by their old ways, and they ate acorns, carrion, roots, snakes. They never did participate in the free corn. And of course, as we were building, as I was building the fence and building the gates, there were some that didn't like the gates and didn't like the fence, and they stopped coming in. Some of them who partook of the free corn took a look at it and decided that they didn't want it, but that was only a few. You see, most of them, because the corn was there, and most of them could see that I was their benefactor and that I was no threat and that I meant them no harm, didn't have any problem going in and out of the gates. Didn't have any problem going in and out. So I stopped feeding them every day. I fed them every other day. Now they became desperate, and they would squeal for feed. And they would be there early in the morning, and then when I would arrive, they would squeal and follow me as I went in, and I threw the corn off the wagon onto the ground. They had now become so totally dependent upon the free corn that they could not hunt snakes. They could not survive out in the open by themselves. They had become now totally dependent upon me, totally dependent upon the free corn. I did that for about 2 weeks until I'd used up all of the corn, and I got all of the pigs that I possibly could used to going through the two gates. Last Friday, I closed one of the gates, leaving only one gate, only one way in and one way out. Many of the hogs could see that this wasn't good, and they would sniff and smell, and they would grunt and runt. But being totally dependent upon the corn, they had no other choice but to go in. They were nervous. They would look at the gate. Well, yesterday I went in, and I fed them, and I came back out, and then went on down the road. But last night I came back in again, and I fed them a second time, and they came in, and when I drove out, I closed the gate. And now I have 3,000 hogs penned up in the Okefenokee, and we need 50 wagons to haul them to market. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my webpage, georgegordon.org. Or you can call the Law School direct at area code 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we'll go back now to the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. You know, we Americans were a wild and a free people from the Revolutionary War to about 1900. And we Americans were eating off of our own land. We went out and we produced, we worked, and we tamed the land, and we fenced it. And we built our homes and our factories and our offices and cities and our buildings. And we became wild and free. And Americans took great pride in the fact that they were wild and free until about 1933. By 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected President of the United States. And because in 1913, for about 20 years, we had been eating so much free credit and paper money, by 1933, we Americans became totally dependent upon our economy, a false, a fictitious, a deceptive economy produced by an organization called the Federal Reserve Bank. And when a Great Depression occurred in 1929, 30, 31, 32, the people of America could no longer make a living. The wild, free Americans started eating free credit. They started taking the benefits that came from the government and from the economy. In 1935, Franklin D. Roosevelt instituted a new program called the Social Security Program, or the Social Security Trust Fund. It wasn't a trust fund. It doesn't offer security. It is definitely social. But a Social Security beneficiary is a ward of the state. And the holder of a Social Security numbered account is in effect or is in the nature of a ward of the state. And the law of wards of state provides that he who is incapable of caring for himself, whether he's young or old, crippled, insane, infant, feeble, or otherwise incapacitated, his total estate escheats to the state in liquidation of the costs of that care and ward. All holders of Social Security account numbers, as a matter of law, forfeit at law ownership of their total estate. Thus, those beneficiaries of government doles and promises are reduced to mere trustees in equity over that property. It produces what we call in law a guardian-ward relationship. Now, if we look at guardian and ward in American jurisprudence, it's an encyclopedia of law, Volume 39, Section 1, under Guardian, we find that the definition and nature of a guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character. It's religious in nature. It's of a sacred character in which one person who is called a guardian acts for another person who is called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. Wards are looked upon by the law as being incompetent, unable to manage their own affairs. Now, a curator is a guardian appointed by the court to control property of a minor. He's not a guardian of the person. He's just the guardian of the property. And in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. So now we have guardians, curators, and conservators. Now, a conservator has the same power and obligation as a guardian insofar as they relate to the property of the ward, so that, in effect, he is the guardian of the estate. Now, the purpose of statutes that relate to these guardianships is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons. So the courts should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. Now, the court, having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter, is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. The guardian-ward relationship. Now, in several states, statutes authorize a person who, although he may be of sound mind, when he believes that he is incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, or he may request, or he may simply consent to the appointment of a conservator, or a guardian of his estate, or of his person, or both, who, when appointed, possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as the guardian of an incompetent. Now remember, I mentioned 1935 and Social Security. You see, up until 1935, Americans were wild and free. They went out and they found employment. If they didn't find employment, then they worked on their own farms. They bought, they sold, they traded, they were traders at law. They used gold and silver coin. They were wild. They were free. They were competent. They were able. But after 1935, a new status was created in a guardian-ward relationship. Today, some 70 years later, we see American workers, they're told when to go to work, when to get up in the morning, what to do in between, when to go to bed at night. They're told what kind of shoes to wear, what kind of eyewear to wear, what kind of hard hats to put on. We have a guardianship cradled to the grave security blanket. It's called the safety net. It's to protect incompetent workers who are no longer capable or able to take care of themselves, and they have to have workers' compensation. That's why we have workmen's compensation, for all of those workmen out there who, when they break their legs on the job, don't have enough money and cannot pay for or provide their own medical care. People who are incompetent and unable to determine whether the job site is safe or unsafe and whether they should or should not work there. So we have to have OSHA inspectors, and they go out and inspect the job site for us to make sure that we don't hurt ourselves when we're working, that we don't pick up 100 pounds, so we limit it to 50 pounds, so you don't hurt your back. After all, the American worker is unable to determine for himself how much he can or cannot lift, how much work he can or cannot do, or whether or not the job site is safe or unsafe. That's called the guardian-ward relationship. Now, there's another body of law that comes into play here, and that's Hale versus Hinkle. Back in 1905, the Supreme Court of the United States made an interesting judgment. Interesting because it delineated or separated individuals who are competent, able, wild, and free to take care of themselves from those that are tame, enslaved, caged, unable to take care of themselves. And it's called corporate capacity. The individual versus corporate capacity. And the issue came up when the controller of the American Tobacco Company, the company controller, was served with a subpoena to produce the company's records and books to the IRS for an audit. And he said, no, the American Tobacco Company under the 14th Amendment is a person, and a person has rights, and a person with rights has to have due process of law and a search warrant. Well, the case wound its way through the judicial process, and in 1905, the Supreme Court of the United States issued its opinion and told us what the answer was concerning corporations and individuals. The court said, conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation, and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers. We are of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter, the corporation, has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. But the court went on to delineate between the two and said that the individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen, that the individual is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way, that the individual has power to conduct and to contract, and that power to conduct and to contract is unlimited. The individual owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business, or to open his doors to an investigation so far as it may tend to incriminate him. The individual owes no such duty to the state, since he receives nothing from the state beyond the protection of his life and property, which he has a right to under the Constitution. The individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state. And those rights can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with our Constitution. Among the individual's rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure except under a warrant of the law. An individual owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. Well, the court went on now to explain the distinction between this individual and a corporation when they said, on the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state, and it is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. Corporations receive certain special privileges and franchises, and corporations hold those special privileges and franchises subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of its charter. The corporation's powers are limited by law, and corporations can make no contracts not authorized by their charters. Corporations' rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to those corporations so long as they obey the laws of their creator. There's a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it has exceeded its powers, and it would be a strange anomaly indeed to hold that a state having chartered a corporation to make use of certain franchises could not, in the exercise of its sovereignty, inquire as to how those franchises had been employed and whether they had been abused, and then demand the production of the corporate books and papers for that purpose. Now, when we compare the average worker, the average American citizen today, with a wild hog of the Okefenokee, we find that our citizens today, under Social Security, under corporate capacity, pursuant to Hale versus Henkel, have now become wards of the state. No longer the wild and free Americans of the 20th century or the 19th century or the 18th century, but instead they've become now dependent upon the economy, dependent upon government, dependent upon being fed by their masters, by their employers, by their government, by their welfare agencies. Now, Americans used to take pride in our common law. The common law was the law of the land up until about 1900. Starting around 1900, we began to make some changes. In 1913, we established a Federal Reserve Bank and paper money as the primary source of transacting trade, commerce, business, and industry, which affected all public interest. Prior to 1900, Americans were proud, wild, and free, and dealt in gold and silver. They dealt in increase, and they tithed, and they obeyed God and kept His commandments. As time progressed along, we obeyed God less and obeyed our government, our state, and our guardians more. Now, some common changes that occurred was that in 1900, we practiced land held in fee simple. Today, we practice mortgages and we brag about shopping for a mortgage, shopping for an interest rate, which is clearly a violation of the law of God. In 1900, we owned our labor, but today, we have Social Security numbers, and our Social Security number has created a guardian-ward relationship. We no longer own our labor. The state now owns all of our labor for all of our lives. And we receive for our labor a security blanket. We used to practice in this country substance. We dealt in chickens and cows. We dealt in land and gold and silver. Today we deal in Federal Reserve notes, a piece of paper that represents a deposit. It represents real money. It's not real money of and by itself, but we believe it is. So we no longer practice substance, that is gold for cows and cows for chickens, or gold or silver for land. We now practice negotiable instruments, Federal Reserve notes and checks and credit cards. Americans used to be proud and practice inalienable rights. Today, we have traded our inalienable rights for government-granted privileges, and we now have marriage licenses and birth certificates, driver's licenses, business licenses to conduct our everyday affairs. And along with those licenses come guardians. Highway patrolmen become our guardians to protect us against ourselves when we're driving on the highways. And social lady becomes our guardian to protect us and our families and our children. We now have public schools that educate our children. Americans are no longer competent or capable any longer of educating their own children. We used to believe in this country in property and property rights. Today we believe in equitable interests, and so we buy stocks and bonds. We don't own our own hot dog stand. We have 50 shares of Walmart. We used to practice gold and silver coin, that is, just weights and balances, pursuant to Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16, and Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Today, we use bank and corporate credit cards. But our credit cards say they're gold cards. They're not gold. And they don't represent gold and silver. They represent irredeemable paper money in a guardian-ward relationship, in which, when you sign this contract, you agree to binding arbitration. You can't even go into court and sue your master because you've agreed not to. And that's because you went to the government school and you didn't learn how to read. And so you're incompetent and unable to read contracts and know what the terms and conditions of these contracts are. We used to believe in private ownership in America. Today, we no longer believe in private ownership. We believe in stocks and negotiable instruments. So we practice commercial paper rather than private ownership of land or property and fee. We used to believe in private property. Today, we believe in bonds. We used to practice private business, but today we have public business licenses. So if you're a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, or some other professional, you have a license issued by your master to conduct your business. You're not free as a doctor to determine what is right or what is wrong in treatment of your patients. That's decided by your legislature. And then you follow the licensing agreement, and if you don't, you go to jail. We used to believe in private rights. Today, we believe in permits. So we get permits to build our houses. Our forefathers were competent people. They may have only built a sod house on the Nebraska prairie, but they didn't need anyone's permit or permission to build it. And it might fall down, and it might hurt them, but they didn't need a building inspector to inspect it. We used to practice common law occupations, but today we want our children to go to college so that they can become public interest professionals, so that they can be licensed, bonded, and insured, so that they can enter into a licensing agreement with their masters in a guardian-ward relationship. We used to believe in substance and chattels. Today, we believe in interest-bearing accounts. We're no longer able to manage our own money and financial affairs, so we need accountants, bookkeepers, bankers, and tax specialists to count our money for us. We used to practice warehouse receipts and checks, spelled C-H-E-Q-U-E-S, but today we practice checks, C-H-E-C-K-S. The difference is that a C-H-E-C-K is a credit, whereas a C-H-E-Q-U-E is a warehouse receipt. You see, in 1900, if you wanted to send $1,000 to California, you would have put $1,000 in gold on the counter and sent a warehouse receipt. Today, you don't have any substance. So you take your computer chips and you write out a piece of paper, and your master at the bank handles your money for you. He transfers 1,000 credits, but the $1,000 in gold remains in the bank. You don't have any gold, boys and girls. You're not competent. You're not capable. You're not able to manage real money. Now, we used to practice individual responsibility in America. Today, we practice insurance. That's called limited liability. We practice limited liability because we're no longer able to be responsible for our own actions. And so we pay $500 and buy an auto insurance policy. In my state, we call that the Financial Responsibility Act of 1976. Everybody believes in insurance. It's prohibited in the scripture. God demands strict liability. Not only don't we obey God, but we pay through the nose for our insurance, because insurance creates a guardian-ward relationship in which you're no longer responsible for your actions. The insurance company is. So the insurance company goes to the legislature, and they get seatbelt laws and drunk driving laws enacted, and car seats for babies enacted to protect you, to protect the claims window of the insurance industry. Because after all, you're not competent and capable any longer of taking care of or deciding for yourself. So the insurance company becomes your guardian. We used to practice patriarchal family in America. Today, we practice matriarchal family with marriage licenses. Today, women rule over us, and children are our oppressors, which is exactly what God told us through the prophet Isaiah would happen. If we couldn't maintain a patriarchal family, well, then the state would come in and neuter all of us men, make our wives our masters, our children our oppressors. And when the divorce comes, boys, you all know as well as I do, just bend over, stick your head between your knees, and kiss your ass goodbye. Now, isn't that true? And then finally, we have now exchanged our status as individuals for citizenship. Citizenship in the civil law state, the Roman civil law, now prevails where our common law used to prevail. Our common law came from Moses at Mount Sinai. Our civil law comes from Rome. We now practice the Roman civil law. We practice income, and we pay an income tax instead of practicing increase and paying a tithe. And you know, most Americans would rather pay 30, 40, 50, and at one time as much as 91% income tax than to pay 10% to God. I mean, you talk about being wild and rebellious. But not wild and rebellious like the wild hogs of the Okefenokee. Wild and rebellious against God. Wild and rebellious against common sense. Wild and rebellious against freedom. So, we Americans, like the wild hogs of the Okefenokee, have participated in the free corn and the free lunch until today. George Bush, through the Patriot Act and Homeland Security, closed the gate. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, why don't you go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.